This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Honey Badger.
Your code is going to have errors, even code written by an amazing developer such as yourself. When bad things happen, it's nice to know that Honey Badger has your back. Honey Badger makes you a DevOps hero by combining error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron monitoring into a single, easy-to-use platform, saving you time and your cash. Remote Ruby listeners get 30% off for 6 months. Simply mention Remote Ruby when signing up and they'll apply the discount to your account. No credit card required.
This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
What's up, Andrew?
What's up, Chris? How's it going?
Pretty good. You know, it's one of those weeks where it's Friday. I don't really know how we got to Friday. I don't remember what I did. You know, it's a good week, right?
Yeah, I have felt like I'm stuck in like the Bermuda Triangle recently. Time, it slips in and out, and like I start my day and then all of a sudden it's 4 o'clock and I'm ready to crawl into like a cabinet.
Yep, I hear you. I guess that was one of the things I used to do as a kid, was crawl into cabinets in the kitchen and then just sit there quietly for as long as I could till I was found.
Oh man.
And it would freak my mom out because like I would just disappear. And then like, who's going to go look for their kid in a cabinet like that?
So, right.
Yeah.
I didn't hide in the cabinets, but I was a constant tree climber. So I was usually perched on top of a tree and I fell off many trees, which kind of explains some things.
Oh man, that's funny. Did you break any bones falling out?
I never broke a bone falling out of a tree, but I have broken both arms, one of them twice. So,
oh, man.
But for like stupid stuff.
I've never broken any bones actually, but yeah, you don't want to break your arms or your fingers, at least doing what you do, because the speech to text programming is still not quite there yet.
No, I mean, I've broken both arms, but the real problem is that I've had at least 3 concussions. So breaking your brain is a lot more painful.
Yeah, that one's not good. Maybe that's why you like Hamill so much.
I'm not even going to dignify that with the response.
Oh, man. I just had to, you know. Jason isn't here this week. He has been moving to a new house. And I guess when they remodeled the house, who we bought it from kind of like ripped out all of the coax cables. So they're like,
I know.
He sent us pictures of coax cables running outside on his porch to try and get internet to his house. And we were both like, well, that's pretty rough. So
yeah. Yeah. I don't envy that position. I'm sure that's really frustrating.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, did they just rush it, you know, to like fix stuff, like, or just forgot or what? It's just one of those things that you don't see that as a thing you're looking at when you're buying a house. You like, don't pay attention to those details. But then it's strange because the second you move in, that's the first thing you want to know. For some reason, that doesn't register as a question you're going to have ahead of time. And I feel like that's the same thing when you're like designing software and then you go to build it and then you're like, wait a minute, what is this? How are we even going to build that? You know, and then the designs are like, they seemed good until we actually try to write code and you're like, that's weird.
Yeah, this is definitely not going to work.
Yeah, it's funny because I worked for so many years with like a designer who would work at like an advertising agency or something. And then they would design stuff that looked pretty, but wouldn't really think about, okay, what if someone uploads a video? Like if we were designing like a YouTube kind of site, what happens if someone writes a title that's like 100 characters long? The designs would always be like some mock-up of some short title or whatever. And then I'm like, what do you want me to do when it wraps, you know? Or like, do we truncate it? Do we let it wrap? But do we truncate it after 2 lines or something? And, you know, it was always interesting to see that like gap between the theoretical designs and then like the reality was always like, okay, what if someone uploaded a thumbnail that was way too small or way too big or whatever, we have to, you know, crop it. But if we keep the original dimensions, you know, then it might look weird and we got to center the images and we usually want to make it all the same size. And there's a lot of nuance to it that you just don't know until you dig in. It's fascinating.
Yeah. I always felt like following a mock-up like as closely as possible led to a lot of like really nasty CSS and also led to a lot of non-responsive design. Because they're like, this container has to be this wide because all these elements underneath it have to be, you know, this wide. And then suddenly you're like adding explicit widths to stuff and you're like, this is wrong, but I don't know how to accomplish this any other way.
And like you'd be given a PSD that's like just the desktop and it's a certain version of the desktop. And it's like, this is going to look really dumb on a, you know, a 27-inch wide monitor if the browser is that wide. Or look really strange or, you know, won't even work on mobile. It's a fascinating thing. I don't know if humans are just naturally bad at that, of like predicting those little details in the future that they'll have to implement. But yeah, I've always been fascinated by that. Like, why are we so bad at, you know, imagining those little details later on? But yeah, I don't mind using Tailwind UI these days and just tweaking that. Instead of, you know, having a PSD that I have to go and try and make pixel perfect, was the worst.
Yeah, I escaped the PSD age. By the time I was developing, it was Sketch was really, really popular. I remember when I first started, and I don't think Figma had come out yet, but I know that's really popular right now. And then InVision. I remember a lot of InVision mockups that I guess were created in Sketch maybe. And then there was like interactivity or the kind of wireframing was done in InVision.
Yeah, that's the one where you can upload like, you know, an image and then you can draw a box and make it clickable to link to another page or mockup of a page. Yeah, I did use that a little bit. I don't see that as often anymore, but also the work I've done has kind of changed. So I don't work with a designer like I used to.
Yeah. I know a lot of tools now have it kind of built in because I remember when I started, I think I reached for Adobe XD. I think it was kind of brand new around that time. And I had an Adobe Creative Cloud subscription through the university. So Adobe XD allowed you to do that and like inside the program. So you didn't need two programs. And I think Figma does as well, but I'm not 100% sure. So that might also be part of the reasons that InVision is not as needed anymore, because now a lot of these tools have the ability to create those kind of workflow diagrams where you can click through to the next page, like already built in.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, it seems like the logical feature that they would all add, you know, it makes so much sense. So especially with stuff like Sketch is great, but the benefit of Figma is you can get on any computer. You don't have to fiddle with your product key and try and install that and whatever. You know, that's just a pain. And then being able to just hop in Figma and it's always the same thing everywhere is worth it, you know. Jumping into some Ruby stuff, did you see the Raktor announcement or whatever today that it got accepted? I guess then that's so like a for sure thing that'll be in the next Ruby, I guess.
Yeah, Matt signed off on it today, I believe. And I have heard of it. And it is hard for my small brain to wrap around. I will say that. I took a look at the write-up about it. And I was like, this is solving problems I either don't know about or don't have.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, this is the new... I guess technically it's just the new name for guilds. And then I always thought that was definitely a Ruby 3 feature. So I guess it's official now. Have you written much multi-threaded code before?
I have not. But I've written a little bit recently, but no, not typically. Because, I mean, in Rails, like this to me is something like you would be doing more so if you're writing a gem or something, because... Yeah, in Rails, I'm just going to offload it to Sidekick.
Right. Or Puma or Passenger or your web servers spun up the threads. So really in Rails, like the main controller and view code and all that is, it's just running inside of a thread and that's about it. Which makes sense. Like you don't have to worry about it. It's a nice, you know, it's a really nice architecture so that you know, as a request comes in, you're not worrying about managing the socket and passing it off to the correct thread to process it and any of that stuff. You know, it's taken care of for you by Nate Berkopek and whoever else works on Puma, and it's all good. And then you've got, yeah, you've got Sidekick with Mike Perham and other people who are like really good at writing concurrent stuff. And then the same thing there is like they choose the thread or process and then hand it off to your code. And then that's where you take it from. It's interesting to see this thing come up because I also don't write a lot of threaded code, but I have. And one of those things way back when was in Python, I was trying to build a GUI tool that would download some files. And so I start building this and I want to do a progress bar, right? And I want the downloads to be resumable. So if it, you know, fails in the middle, we don't have to start from scratch. We can start from where we left off. And so I start building this and I immediately realize something's wrong because the second the download starts, the UI freezes. And I'm like, uh-oh, this is bad. And then I start looking at Google and trying to figure out what is going on. I just don't understand because I'd never written any threaded code before. And they were like, well, that's your problem is you're writing Python, you have the GUI, but then you're making the whole Python interpreter busy with that download. And so the GUI is just not getting any updates. And that was teaching me a little bit about the like, you know, if you're building a video game, and you're building Call of Duty, like there's a main loop generating the frames. And if you ever did any work that took a second long, then you're going to get no frames for a whole second, which would be bad. And I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So I started to look into threads and just like kick off the thread to do the download. And then you had to figure out how to talk between the threads because you want to display the progress. And that's really where the Raptor stuff is trying to, you know, improve things because Ruby's been so good about memory management and the GC and all that. You don't have to worry about it ever for the most part, unless you're like loading 1,000 records into memory or something. And I guess a lot of this stuff is for making concurrency a little bit easier from and trying to shield you away from shared objects in memory. Because the example's always, you know, you're incrementing something in two threads and then the numbers don't match up at the end or whatever, like a bank account balance. And so this sounds like a really cool thing. And it sounds like maybe it will even said one of the things that MRI doesn't provide any in-process parallel computation feature because threads, the interpreter slows down in single thread execution because of fine-grained synchronization without clever optimizations. So it sounds like one of these are, or that is one of the reasons why Raptor, the Ruby actor model is getting introduced, which maybe that helps with performance and stuff in parallel tasks. So that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, that's kind of what I got from it. I guess there are some examples at the bottom of the kind of write-up about it, which we will have in the show notes. But I think I need to see real world examples because right now this doesn't really mean much to me. So yeah. If I can just see someone do like a real feature or like a real life example, then I think it would kind of click. But in terms of just like increasing the concurrency, like immediately, I can think of a Rails app that shall remain unnamed. But every time I go to, and I guess this is not something I work on. This is another app that I pay for. And every time I upload some stuff and submit a form, like the uploads are definitely not happening in the background. You can kind of tell. And submitting the form takes a couple seconds. And I'm like, why is this? What is happening? What is it trying to do? Like, why isn't this? Whatever it's trying to do, it should have been doing like before I was ready to submit this form. And now I'm like here waiting. And I'm like, okay, is it frozen? Is it just still chugging on it? What's going on? And I, like in my head, I can just imagine like the Rails log just being like meow 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 meow, just just scooting by. And I'm like, God, what are they doing? But so yeah, I'm excited to be kind of more write-ups about this And I believe you're right that we will see this in Ruby 3.
Yeah, I'm excited to see examples too, because you know there's a lot of like example code on Threads out there, but then to see how could we write that same thing in the actor pattern, and you know what benefits do we get from that is going to be the interesting thing. Like Python and Ruby have always gotten to be kind of people are disappointed with the concurrency in it, because the funny thing is if you create Threads and you have them all print out the order, like a lot of times it will print out in order, but it's clearly not running parallel, like truly parallel. And so that is one of those things where the interpreter lock, I think it has to do with all the like shared memory and just making sure that nothing goes bad. So hopefully maybe this is one of those things that can work towards less of that or eventually getting rid of it. I've never really understood enough of the internals of Python or Ruby as to why the global interpreter locks are required, but they're always one of the things cited as like language just sucks because you can't really do anything truly in parallel, and everybody's tried to, you know, build their own implementation of it or whatever, like JRuby, which does help because they can use like Java's threading, which is actually true threads. And so there's like benefits to that, but it's always been an issue with the core implementation of Python and Ruby. So seems like a really good thing to have.
Yeah. I don't know enough to be able to comment really further because like I said, I haven't done a lot of threading, but I'm very excited to see what kind of comes out of this and the performance gains or the implementations and implications that this will bring about.
Yeah, me too. And I'm in the same boat. Like, I don't write a whole lot of threaded code because mostly in Rails, you don't have to, which is a thing I'm very thankful for because there's a lot of weird, very hard to debug flaws that can crop up pretty quickly. And that is not, it's not an easy thing. So like when you see Tenderlove diving into some crazy debugger and looking at, you know, some complicated C code to debug some Ruby thing, you're like, boy, I'm glad I don't have to do that very often. Like, I'm happy to let Tenderlove do that.
Yeah. Well, I think he said at a conference one time that he writes C so that no one else has to.
I do remember that. Yeah. Well, we thank him for that because...
A hero.
Yeah. I remember doing a lot of C in college and stuff, and boy, it's just so slow to do anything. It is a weird thing to go back to from Ruby or any scripting language, honestly.
Yeah, I've never written C. I didn't learn it in college because I went to college in the South. Yes, that is a joke about the education system in the South. I wrote Java, so like threading, like I had real threading. And then I wrote Python, which we never got far enough to like for that to be even like introduced as like a concept. So actually, no, I had never even heard of threading until I came to Ruby, even though I have a computer science degree. So
that's interesting.
RIP.
Yeah, we had... no database class, no networking class, no, you know, web class or anything. And so we were like teaching ourselves that on the side because we were like, we want to figure out how to do this stuff. And I was always, you know, I started with, basic. And then I tried to do a little bit of C and stuff. And I was just like, how in the world do I write programs that I can interact with? Like I want buttons and I don't want to just do everything on the command line. You know, no one uses stuff on the command line. No, if you're a developer, you do, but regular users never do. And that's what got me into, okay, I want to do desktop software. And then I realized how much that sucked. And it was really hard to build anything that worked on Mac and Windows and Linux. So that's what led me into like, I'm going to go learn Django and Python because that seems way more cross-platform and way more practical. It was probably a good call because I don't ever want to do like desktop software ever again.
I don't either. Although I am kind of interested in Swift UI, but not interested enough to re-download Xcode. So
Yeah. I'm curious to see what will happen with Electron and if that gets more efficient. But, you know, running a separate browser for each little app seems a little heavy, but, you know, they're not all giant apps like Slack. Slack is a slow one because there's a lot of, I'm sure, tons of JavaScript to build that UI.
Yeah. And in Slack, for every workspace you're in, that's like another process. And they're all hungry for that memory.
Yeah. I always wondered, do they implement those as like almost separate tabs, you know, where it's like a whole new instance? Because when you click on it, it seems to load everything from scratch. And I wondered if like maybe they have effectively like several copies of React loaded because it's separate tabs, you know, and they work independently. Chances are that's the case. That's some of the efficiencies they've, you know, pulled out, where they could have it load inside the Electron app once and then they all would inherit from it or something. But it's interesting to think about that, because that may not even be possible if it's like separate tabs, because, you know, the browser security is always pretty strict about sharing things between tabs.
Yeah. It is what it is. That's how I view it.
Yep. So anything new this week?
No, not really. I haven't been as active as I'd like to be with some of my side projects, but I want to refactor my RuboCopl interaction to take advantage of a few things. Like, number one, I wrote the configuration stuff from hand, and I want to use, what is it, Anyway config from Palkin. It looks really nice, and it looks like it'll solve a lot of my issues, especially because GitHub automatically injects some environment variables, and it looks, and then I also have a config file that I want to reach from. So that looks like a great enhancement. And OctoKit now has the ability to deal with the checks API, which is also written from hand. And there's a few bugs and issues in it, and I've started to attempt to refactor it. And then I just am like, I can't do this right now. Like, I'm very burnt out on that project. And I've been really toying with the idea of just saying, okay, look, this is done. Like, you can use it, but I'm done supporting it, because a lot of the issues are not actual issues with the thing itself. And also, I don't even think I'd recommend using it, really. I mean, a lot of people want to use it for the checks API because they want that ability to see, you know, like on the line, you know, this is where it failed. And I'm like, just why? You can do it, create an action that just runs RuboCopl normally without using any of the checks API, without using my action, and it works fine. And then people just really want that extra UI component. And I'm just like, I'm kind of done with it. You know, I'm kind of done with my time being spent on that.
Yeah. That's kind of what happened with the simple calendar gem for me, where I like wrote it for my own purposes, which was just to learn how to build a gem. And then, you know, people are asking all these questions. And at a certain point, I was like, yeah, I mean, that feature sounds good, but I'm not going to build it. If you want to send me a PR, then I'll review it and then merge it if it's good. And I'm going to give you all the feedback of, you know, we should tweak all these little things to make it more generic for, you know, other people too, because I'm going to have to maintain this sort of going forward. And that approach seems reasonable. Like, it's worked out where you're just like, hey, I'm busy. If you want to send me a PR and you do a good job of it, then I'll merge it. But, you know, I'm not going to add that feature.
Right.
Because I don't need it, you know? And maybe that's an approach you can do. It's nice to not have to put in your README that it's like, this is done. It won't be receiving updates. Then, like, people run away and, you know, it's just kind of disappointing there. But if you can just respond to the issues and the PRs and stuff and just tell people what to do or kind of organize that piece of it, you know, I don't think it's too bad. Sometimes there's the crazy person who's, well, I'm going to rewrite the whole thing so I can do this one feature that I want. And you're like, sorry, dude, I can't merge that.
Yeah.
And that is what it is. But it seems it seems nice if you can continue dedicating a little bit of time, you know, and just tell people, hey, I'm not going to be doing much, but if you want to, happy to review it and, you know, merge it in or whatever. And then maybe eventually you get that person as a collaborator and just give them right access to it if you really like their work and you don't feel like you have to, you know, review it too much.
Yeah, I've thought that's kind of what I'm doing right now, but I really want to like refactor it and then push out this big refactor that should clean up all the stuff and then be done with it. But I haven't been able to get myself to do that. So
I was going to say, what if you write down in the issues all the little things you want to refactor and let other people do it?
I could. I'm not sure anyone will do it. And then, yeah, I don't know. I could. It's something I want to do when I think about it, you know, like,
yeah.
When I think about it, I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. It'll be a good refactor. It'll be some good experience and this and that. And it'll be a good, you know, some cleanup. And then it'll be easier for other people to fork it, make it work for other stuff and this and that. But then when I actually open the code, I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to do this.
Yeah. That, I mean, that's where I feel like if you tell people that you would like to have this done and maybe you'll do it, but maybe someone else will do it, then those are often like those opportunities people don't know that are available to contribute to an open source project. So maybe that's a good thing to throw out there and tag it with help wanted or whatever. And maybe someone will come along and, you know, I remember looking all over at open source projects like that, trying to find little things to contribute. And, you know, even if it's something small, like a piece of that refactoring, it could be worth it to somebody. So
yeah. Yeah, you're right. If you're interested, reach out to me.
Let's face it. Your code is going to have errors, even code written by an amazing developer such as yourself. When bad things happen, it's nice to know that Honey Badger has your back. Honey Badger makes you a DevOps hero by combining error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron monitoring into a single, easy-to-use platform, saving you time and your cash. Honey Badger monitors and sends error alerts in real time with all the context needed to see what's causing the error and where it's hiding in your code so you can quickly fix it and get on with your day. The included uptime and cron monitoring also lets you know when your external services are having issues or your background jobs go AWOL or silently fail. Go to honeybadger.io and discover how Star, Josh, and Ben created a 100% bootstrapped monitoring solution. Why is this important? Self-funding means they only answer to you, the developer, rather than a venture capital overlord. Remote Ruby listeners get 30% off for 6 months. Simply mention Remote Ruby when signing up and they'll apply the discount to your account. No credit card required.
I will say this though, I tweeted this last night, dude. I had to declare GitHub notification bankruptcy.
I saw that. How many notifications did you have?
Over 2,000.
Oh man, that's funny.
And I didn't realize it. I didn't realize it because, I mean, I guess I was following projects and I didn't really realize that. But also now, my company uses GitHub a lot more than I'm used to. And because of that, like I completely missed like a notification on an issue that I was tagged on. And I was like, because someone was like, well, yeah, well, didn't you see blah, blah, blah comment? And I was like, no, what comment? And they showed me and I was like, oh my God. I was like, I have to get my notifications under control because now I actually need some of them, but I just have so many that I just ignore them. And I've never, ever had my email notifications on and I never will do that.
Okay. Yeah. See, I don't ever go into the notifications page. It's always from email for me.
Oh yeah. No way. I can't because I don't even check my email as much as I ought to. So like why add to that? I used to use Octobox. It was my homepage on when I would open a new Safari window. And that was basically what GitHub notifications kind of now looks like with their new UI. So I used that and that helped for a while. And there have been times where I'm going to go through and start doing this and that. And someone replied to that comment and it triggered me literally because They were like, yeah, as soon as you like trim down all your notifications, you're just going to get a notification on every single repository that there's like a security update. And I was like, oh my God, stop. This is like way too true. That's something that's been happening and it really aggravates me. So I went through and I started deleting and archiving projects. And for some reason, Dependabot still will, even if it's archived, it will still like create like a notification for security issues. And I'm like, I don't want this. And so the only option is to go project by project, turning off those notifications or archiving the project or whatever. And I'm like, I start to get through it, but I have almost like 200 projects on GitHub or something like that. Mm-hmm. Some stupid amount, way less now that I've went through and started archiving and deleting and stuff, but still too many.
Yeah. The GoRails GitHub account has 300 some projects. And I know my personal one has 300 some repos, and those security notifications are endless. And those, I will pay attention to the security tab when I go to the, you know, Jumpstart or GoRails or Hatchbox or whatever. But for everything else, I just delete that email when it comes in. That's, here's all your security updates, because it's, I'm never going to update any of these old, you know, projects, and that's fine. Like they are what they were when I created them, and that's it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is a nightmare. And then, yeah, I don't star a lot of... Does starring a repo get any notifications? I think it's just watching, right?
It's just watching. And it's a good thing it does. Yeah, you can watch and subscribe. And you can change it so like you only get a notification for releases and things like that. But yeah, starring doesn't. And thank God, because I'm checking right now. I got way overboard with the starring. I don't even think it'll tell me how many I have. I think the last time I looked, it was over 1,000.
Yeah. And it's like, when are you going to go through all those?
Yeah, I'm not. So at this point, it just like, when I go to a repo and I see that I've already started, I'm like, okay, well, that means that I either looked into this in the past and wanted to use it, or I don't know. It kind of gives me like an indication of, okay, past me was here. So maybe future me or present me can see what's up.
Yeah, it's interesting. It looks like I have almost 300 stars, and looking through these, hey, it's my own repository. Like, why is that starred? I don't care. You know, I already know I have that repository. I don't need a reminder of it. And there's a few in here that are like the Basecamp full request logger, and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And there's a few that are nice, but like, when you've got that many stars, you're not going to go back and reference them. So yeah, it's kind of a weird thing. Like, I remember clicking star on a bunch of things over the years, and like, I never went back to them ever. And it's just, you know, it's interesting to see those features that you could build in your app, like starring. And then if you're not careful about how users use it, it might just be a useless feature that you got to maintain forever then, you know? Like, I'd be really curious to see how many people actually view and search through their stars. It's probably a significant amount, but it's also probably like the people who just kind of habitually star things will never go back through that. And it's almost useless, you know?
Yeah. And I am a habitual star. I have 1,400 stars right now. And I think the problem with the stars is that it's like a simple feature, but I feel like at some point it should have been expanded and it never was, because starring is kind of like a bookmark to me on GitHub. Mm-hmm. But you can categorize them by title by language, but that's it. And ideally, I'm gonna call it bookmarking, not stars. If you could bookmark something into a specific label, that's okay, I want to look back at this. Or every time you find like a Ruby security library, you can specifically give that a bookmark, a named bookmark. That would be like my dream for stars. And I actually started to build something to do that, and I just haven't had time to get back to it. But it is my dream to one day finally take all the crap in my GitHub stars and do something with it. Because I have cool stars. I find stuff in there. Sometimes I do go through it. Not all of it, obviously, because I have, 700 Ruby projects starred. But occasionally I'll go through some of them to find something that I've starred recently. And I'm like, oh, this is super cool. This is super cool. This is super cool. I remember why I starred this, but I don't have a use case for it right now. Or it's just too much. It's just so much.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That would be really cool to have an organization thing like that. I felt like Twitter would be really awesome if you could follow a person, but by topic. Like you could follow DHH and just filter out any of the, just the Rails and JavaScript posts that he makes. No Facebook rants or whatever. That would be really cool. But yeah, it adds a layer of complexity to the stars that is maybe it's questionable value. But if you build that as a separate tool that you can pull in someone's stars and then let them organize it, that makes a lot more sense, because I don't feel like GitHub will get much value out of doing that. But the stars, power users like you, could absolutely benefit from that. That's a really good project to, if someone wants to go build that and then look at, if you've never synced data from an API before, that's a really good project to do, where you're now I got to pull in the changes. And then I also have to figure out, if Andrew unstarred something, how do I know about that? And how do I remove it when we sync the next time? And, those things are kind of fun. Or maybe we just have just keeps track of those things forever, and it's an archive of all your stars that you ever did or something. But yeah, those are little fun projects I like doing on the weekends, because they're small enough, but they're still kind of practical. That's a good one.
Yeah. I mean, and if you think about it, a star on GitHub is a pretty easy to grasp concept if you know Rails. I mean, you have a user and you have a repository, and now you just have another record that's, okay, this user, I don't know what they would call, maybe they just call it stars. It's just literally a user and a repository ID probably.
Yeah, something awfully simple, I would imagine, because it's just it's like you're following someone. It's just the record needs to join the two things, and that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm looking at this page, and outside of repo specific information, the only other thing on here is saying when I start it. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, AKA a created at,
right?
So. I would love to build that one day. It is on my list of things I will build, along with all the infinite other things I want to build, but we'll see. I have a dream where I star something on GitHub and it automatically is synced through the API to to my app that aggregates it somehow. And then I know someone that's Mike Rogers. I think he listens to this podcast. He has built something like this to handle all of his activities. So if he stars something on GitHub, or if he, I can't remember the other, if he likes something on Twitter, I think it all gets synced into this app he made, I believe. But he said it's kind of cool. Littered with personal keys. So
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
That is a really cool idea. I like that. It's like one of the things I've always thought about was Spotify does a mixtape every week. And I just want to have all of those archived every week, add them to a list so I can go back and see those. Because I like that it changes every week. It's just, what if I missed something last week? I'll never know. And, maybe it'll come back, but whatever. It's nice to be able to keep that historical data and just analyze it later, whatever. It's fun.
Yeah. And my dream was that if I built this service specifically just for GitHub stars, then each week I would create a email for my email subscribers, which I have actually never emailed, even though I have a list, but I have never emailed it, even though there are people on it. So maybe one day. But my dream was that every time I star something on GitHub, at the end of the week, it just has a list of the stars that I've made, and then I can just quickly plop those into my email subscribers. I don't even remember what it's called now. My email newsletter. There you go.
You don't even remember the name. That's how long it's been.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. One day. you reminded me of, so a long time ago, I built two little apps that were just tools for myself, and they turned out to be really cool. One was called Oauthable, and I went and tried to download every single Oauth or OmniAuth gem that existed and put them in the same app. And then you could, I learned how to dynamically switch out the keys based on the user. And I made it so that you could grab API keys from Oauth without building it in your app, which is kind of cool. Because sometimes if you're building a one-off thing to sync, you know, your GitHub stars, you just need your access token and you don't need to actually build login with GitHub. And that was a fun one. But the one that you actually reminded me of was, you know, like the concept of like storing this historical stuff. When you're testing out webhooks, it's a real pain because if you're testing out like Stripe webhooks, you receive the webhook and then it's over. And like you have it in the Rails logs as like a hash or a string of a hash, and there's no way to rerun it. And if you use their test webhooks, it sends you like invalid data, you know, a zero for an ID or something that obviously doesn't exist in your database. So I built this site called Webhook Monitor, and I don't think it works anymore. But you would send your webhooks to that, and it would just take the data that was passed in and store it in the database. And then you could just copy that JSON and then send it to your app, you know, locally. And then you could just repeat it. So if you had a bug or you were like trying to figure out how to do something, you could just repeatedly send that exact same webhook over and over, you know, for development. And then I was going to try and build like a little, almost like an ngrok or whatever, where it would pull in things that were sent, because that was the other issue. There's a lot of services that you want to, you know, send to local host or something. But unless you're paying for ngrok, local tunnel hasn't been reliable and it's been down and it's just kind of a pain. So I was like, I'll just send all my webhooks to this little service and then be able to run them against my local host, you know, really easily. And that turned out to be like a really fun little project. And I think I was trying to learn Foundation instead of Bootstrap then, just to see what it was like, which meant that that project was doomed because that was like the only project I ever did in Foundation.
Right.
And when I came back to it to work on it, I was like, ew, this is Foundation and I don't want to bother rewriting this in Bootstrap. So I'm just not going to do this. And yeah. I don't think I ever really did much with it.
I've never even heard of Foundation, which I'm surprised. I thought I knew all of them.
Zurb Foundation was the big alternative to Bootstrap for a long time. And it was kind of like shortly after Bootstrap came out. And it had a lot of pros to using it over Bootstrap. They have email, template, CSS stuff, and a lot more components and whatever. But it ended up being like, I think it's like a consulting company or an agency or something that originally was using it, so that it had kind of that, rather than being extracted from Twitter like Bootstrap was, like one product, this was like, we need something to build all these different designs and whatever. And it seemed really nice for that. But as you know, Tailwind really hit the nail on the head. So yeah, well, I imagine a lot of things eventually will move to Tailwind, but these will probably just stick around for a long time.
While you were talking about your webhooks, you reminded me of a project that the folks at Honey Badger cooked up called Hook Relay. And I got in on their alpha test because I believe to be on the Heroku marketplace, you have to have 10 people alpha test your integration or whatever it is, and then you can get it on their store. So I volunteered to be one of the alpha testers and it was super cool. And what it basically was is a service that you send your webhooks to, and then that service sends them to your app. So it has built-in guard against SSRF and background jobs and, you know, timeouts and recording delivery results and logging and retries and this and that. So if you're interested in that, it's hookrelay.dev is the site. And it is, I believe, a Jumpstart app.
Yeah, it is. It's a Jumpstart Pro app, which is really cool. Because what's really cool is like Ben originally did, what was it, Rails kits, I think?
Yes.
Way back when. I had no idea it was Ben Curtis that made that. And he DM'd me on Twitter one day and was like, man, Jumpstart Pro is what I wish I would have built back in the day with Rails kits. And I was like, wow, that is that's saying something. So I was really excited to see that they were using it for Hook Relay. And I got in the beta 2, I believe, but I never actually used it yet. So I need to do that because it's a really cool idea. I mean, when he mentioned it, I was like, oh, that's like awfully similar to what I did for fun way, way back in the day. So yeah, I like that idea a lot. It's a cool concept and it definitely makes debugging and, you know, building things with webhooks a million times easier, I feel like.
Yeah, I actually gave it a try. I hooked it into Discord, into it. Like I gave it like a Discord webhook and I played around with it. It's really cool. I definitely suggest taking a look if you've never heard of it. And they are sponsoring this podcast, hashtag thank you, Honey Badger, but that is not the reason we're riffing on this because this is it's really cool, I think.
Yeah. Well, Honey Badger, they're just good people building good things and, you know, bootstrapping business in the community, which is great. So yeah, I like them. Before we get wrapped up here, the other topic that I think we're originally going to talk a lot more about was how we can bring more, you know, beginners into Rails. Like the one thing that was the most disappointing about that Rails hosting survey was only like 4% or something of the respondees had, what was it, like under a year of experience or something with Rails. It was very low. The number of newcomers to Rails that answered that survey was very low. Now, that might be partially because they didn't know of the survey, but also, you know, it seems like that's naturally the case right now. There's just not a lot of beginners.
I'm not sure because I think there's a lot of bias baked into those results, like not intentionally by any means, but to hear about how did you hear about that survey?
I'd known about it for years, but it was either on Ruby Weekly or something like that I saw it posted. But actually one of the people that worked at, I think it's Arkansas that put that survey on.
No, it's Planet Argon.
Planet Argon, that's what it was. Yeah. One of them emailed me about it and was like, hey, could you forward this to your community? Which I did. But yeah, I think you're right because I remember years ago when that survey came out and I'm looking at the questions and I'm like, I can't really answer any of these because like I deploy to Heroku and I don't feel qualified to answer any of these things because they're like hobby projects or, you know, they're not really production things. So I don't want to even answer the survey because I don't feel like I'm contributing like valuable results. And I bet you there's a lot of other juniors that are in that same boat.
Yeah. I was going to say, I heard about it on Twitter. So immediately, and I think the main areas you probably would hear about it, if you didn't see it on maybe a post on Reddit or in Ruby Weekly, because then you have to be subscribed to Ruby Weekly. So then you have to assume that people know about Ruby Weekly. And I think a lot of it kind of extends back into Twitter. So automatically you're kind of losing anyone who's not on Twitter, which is a lot. So, and yeah, I think also you're right that there are people who are like, I don't feel qualified to answer this. So I don't know. I'm not sure how accurate those specific results were in terms of, you know, who's new to Ruby and stuff like that. Because I've seen people who are new to Ruby. Like I'm working with a junior at work. Will Johnson from Egghead is learning Ruby and I've talked to him a little bit. And so I know there are people, and whenever I've gone to RailsConf or RubyConf and they say, is this your first time here? Or who's new to Ruby or Rails? It's the majority of the room, it seems. So yeah, I feel like because that survey was kind of distributed in circles where you're either A, on Twitter and already following other Rubyists, and B, like in just kind of Rails communities. If you're a junior and you don't know those communities exist yet, then you automatically lose all those answers. So yeah, it could be accurate, and I don't doubt that there is not a lot of people coming into Ruby right now, and that's sad, but it's just kind of a fact that JavaScript is eating the world. So I don't doubt that there is a low number. I'm just not sure how low it really is.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I would agree with that. The lack of boot camps pushing Rails anymore, I think, is, you know, one of the things that people like look at as they're a junior. You know, they're like, I don't really know what to learn. And when I was learning, I didn't know what to learn. The reason I went with Python before Ruby was like, Python's everywhere. It's already installed on Linux. And I have to go figure out how to install Ruby. And I was trying to do stuff with offline Linux computers. So I had to go with whatever was already installed. And yeah, there needs to be, you know, more of that. And maybe the community will come up with a bootcamp style of thing that's, you know, a popular one. But, you know, there's a lot less of that. A lot of them are JavaScript. I feel like a lot of the bootcamps have died off too. Lambda School is kind of the big one left.
Yeah.
And they're doing a good job, you know, for the most part. But there's not enough help or mentorship to get new people on. Like when we talked to Steve Polito, like he felt very nervous about, you know, his experience as a Ruby and Rails developer, you know, and then talking with us, he knew a lot more than I think he gave himself credit for.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of, you know, juniors feel the same way. So there probably needs to be a whole lot more support around him. Like, it would be cool to, you know, companies don't have, I'm curious to hear, you know, where you work now, the junior, does that person have a sort of almost a curriculum or anything to get more up to speed and pass their junior status, you know? Or is it kind of just like they work like everybody else, but there's not really formal kind of training going on?
I'm not sure, to be totally honest. I'm not sure. There totally could be. I'm not aware. When I was a junior, I was assigned a mentor, and that was basically it. But that helped a lot. So I know for the junior I'm now working with, like I've specifically reached out to him, and or if I find something cool in Ruby or like a cool trick with Pry or something like that, I'll send it to him. And the other day we paired on helping fix some stuff in his environment, and I got him set up with VS Code instead of Atom, and kind of added like he had ZSH and kind of Bash, because you know how ZSH now ships with Bash, or Mac now ships with ZSH. Yeah. So I helped him just kind of configure a few things, and I got him Oh My ZSH and stuff like that. And here's a good question for you. He asked me why to install Oh My ZSH, and I kind of thought about it for a minute, and I was like, I mean, it gives you cool themes. I was like, other than that, like you get the plugin stuff that I like for the aliases. But I was like, what other than really cool themes do you get from Oh My CSH? I wasn't even really sure.
You know, I haven't really fully taken advantage of it either. I originally did it for the themes. Then I like forked a theme and made my own, I believe. And then, yeah, originally it was just like the plugins or the wrappers around the commands like bundle exec, Rails, and Git shortcuts and whatever that are kind of built in. Those were useful, but I haven't really done. I mean, I feel like the same thing with Vim. Like, I use probably 4% of what you could do with Vim, you know, and I'm just like productive with this little tiny amount of stuff. And there's tons more to learn. And I'm sure that there's other benefits, but, you know, and like, you don't indefinitely probably use ZSH without Oh My ZSH, but I've always done it from the beginning because that's what it seemed like everyone else was doing. And I knew there were a few of those built-in shortcuts around Git, and you don't have to go write your own aliases and all that stuff. And that was nice, but Yeah, I couldn't really tell you. It's the same thing.
Well, it sounds like we need to see if Robbie Russell, who is the maintainer of OMYCSH and also the founder of Planet Argon, would be interested in coming on to tell us all the things that we are not taking advantage of.
Yeah, I'm sure he would love to do that, and we would love to have him on. So that would be a fun episode to do. We'll have to make that happen.
Yeah, we will have to do it.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Yeah, you got my mind running a little bit on, you know, I wonder if there's something like could you make a version of GoRails that companies could buy to train up their, you know, juniors? And basically, because like I'm working on this new course of kind of the, I want to explain some of the Ruby stuff that makes Rails possible and how it works behind the scenes. And I've got like 12 videos made already. And this just makes me realize maybe there's something there where, you know, if you hire a junior, the company buys them this course and they go through the course and learn all these things that are like, here's the stuff about Ruby that you really should know if you're going to be a Rails developer. And that makes you really, you know, shortcut a lot of the painful, slow progress you make at the beginning because there's a little too much magic. And really the whole point of this course is like, you know, those Rails routes, like where that get comes from, we're going to go build that and you can see how it works. So the course I'm excited about, but it seems like there needs to be something like that for juniors. So maybe that's what I'll turn it into.
Yeah, that would be cool. I mean, I feel like you could even package that up as something separate and start making that West Boss money.
Yeah, man, that guy's killed it in JavaScript.
Yeah. It's funny. Maybe next episode we'll do our beginner show or talk more about some beginner stuff because that was definitely the most requested thing when I just tweeted out, hey, what do y'all want us to talk about in Remote Ruby today? And there were a few juniors who commented and I messaged the junior I'm working with. And I was like, what about Rails confuses you or what do you want to know more about? And he said, relationships, differences in casing and migrations. And I was like, yep, that is definitely some stuff that can be tricky out of the box. So we'll have to do a show on that. And yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah, that'd be really good. Well, guess we should wrap it up for the week. Have a good weekend. There's no, you know, massive hurricanes heading your way anymore, right?
Not yet, but there will be. They're coming.
We thankfully don't get a whole lot here in the dead middle of the Midwest and the, you know, as far away from water as possible out here.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say it's the way to go, but it is the way to go if you want to avoid hurricanes. So,
yeah, I won't say it's the way to go either.
All right, man. Have a great week. And I will talk to you again next week.
All right. Catch you later.